Accession number 26562, Mr. Ken Taylor, reel number 18. Now, so what happens then when you leave the ice cap?
Well, before we leave, one of the other things, if I mention, quite interesting at night in the winter when you're up there to do with radio propagation, on the sort of medium wave band that, you know, we have on our radios where we listen to the local stations, you could virtually hear all of American local stations right across, right down in Carolina, Texas, and all these local radio stations. The propagation on low frequency was fantastic in the winter out there. And it was quite interesting. Sometimes we sit there and listen amusingly at some of their commercials advertising, you know, there'd be a carol and then they'd advertise a nativity tea towel or something like that, you see, typical American. And the other thing I had to do, I didn't know the reason for it, but HM Submarines, Rugby had a worldwide broadcast on 16 kilocycles, which is now called 16 kilohertz, which radiates worldwide to British submarines all over the world. And they wanted to know what the strength of the signals were, you know, in Greenland. And it's amazing, the absorption over Greenland was so much that I run out, I had a drum of telephone wire, and I run out about a mile and a quarter of wire along the snow surface, and could just barely pick up Rugby on there. When I was back in the base up, I had a DF set to do the same, couldn't pick it up on there. Obviously, it was the submarines going under the ice cap, you know, they're looking ahead, because since then they got satellites and everything else, and global navigations and different things. But I mean, didn't realise why, but that was one of the things I had to do to try and pick. They wanted to know if there was any bending of the waves through the aurora borealis, because the aurora borealis and some of the scenery around the moon is absolutely out of this world.
Well, I was going to ask you about the aurora borealis. However you pronounce it, what was it like? I mean, was it impressive?
Oh yeah, I mean, you could watch for hours. Myriads of colours, all interchanging and waving and wafting up and down. It's absolutely fantastic. And of course, on a clear night, you get all sorts of phenomena around the moon. Sometimes you see the moon with like a white pillar down each side and one in the middle, and then you see that stars, you know, starry things shining around it. It's all to do with ice crystals in the atmosphere, but some of the effects are quite remarkable out there, really are.
So how did you come to leave? I mean, when had you gone there? You were there 9 months. What month had you started at the base, North Ice?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, right. So what happened when you left? How did you get out? Did you have to go back by sledge? Or you?
No. Weasels come up and brought their reliefs.
Now, what was it like travelling in the weasels?
Oh, so comfortable after sledging up. I was just sitting in the back. They drive it like a tank with a couple of levers, you know, sort of on the tracks and sit in the back, had a lot of stuff in there. One of our weasels actually went down a crevasse, Mike Banks, and that's when they were doing the trip. They used to tie the weasels together with long ropes. We have three weasels, and all of a sudden they come across one of these snow bridges and the thing just dropped down. And of course, the other two weasels behind put their sort of brakes on, and it slid forward, and until the other weasel was just at the top, and they were hanging down. And they were lucky; they had their seat belts on, which were just waist belts. So as it went down the crevasse, they both fell forward, and all the stores in the back went shooting over their head out the front window. So you know, if they'd been upright, they would have. You know,
now, was that when you were with them?
When they were going back. And they climbed back out through the rear of the weasel and climbed up the rope back out. And then they untied the rope and just let it go. You know, cause
now, what else do you remember about driving out in the weasels? I mean, you weren't driving, but being driven out.
Oh, it was just quite comfortable, sitting in the back, chatting away merrily. Yeah.
Now, where were you going to? Back to the...
Back to the base, and... Because, you know, I'd been relieved by Dixie. And you know, they had to be informed that there would be no communications back to Admiralty while Dixie was coming out to relieve me. I went back, and then I went back in the base. Then not long after I got back in the base hut, we I suppose it's about the, could be about the August time.
This is a base hut by the lake.
By the lake, yeah. The base hut by the lake. And everybody had their fingers crossed, hoping that the lake would thaw. I mean, it still has ice in it, but it spreads up and the wind will blow it to one end or the other end will be scattered around so they can get some resupply. Because some of the chaps, the seismologist George Cadd from Shell, he worked for Shell, he was going out after 1 year. Then another seismologist was coming up to relieve him. My signal officer was going off back to the army after 1 year. And he was, he wasn't being ridiculous, BK was already. There was a couple of others going back. The physiologist was going back, South African Harold Lewis, the doctor physiologist, he was going back, but left our own doctor with us. So, you know, there was a changeover. Bishop of Portsmouth came up, being a committee member, and also being the holy man, you know, he offered communion to all those who wanted it when he was up there. I missed out because I was on the air, because all the aircraft flying, I was on the air all the time. But so I couldn't take the opportunity to take communion with him, but he gave communion to those who wanted it.
Now, what were you doing back at the base hut, and how long were you there for?
Till the end of the expedition in 1954.
So you were there a long time at the base hut?
Well, just over a year. Yeah, just over.
And what was life like there? Was it better? Or?
Oh, it was different because, it varied because the geologists were working all around Queen Louise Land, and the glaciologists, they had set up a little camp, you know, a little shed they made out of packing cases on the glacier. They were studying the glacier and its movement and, you know, boring holes in it like glaciologists do. Oh, sort of a very boring job, glaciology, actually. Geology fascinated me. Geology, I thought that I found that fascinating, what they did there. But I always thought glaciology was a bit boring.
And what were you doing? Just stuck in the radio?
Well, not based on the radio, but when there's a period when the surface of the glacier, you know, when the sun gets on it, it gets sticky, you know, with the water, and you can't sledge up it. So basically, you get the glaciologists on the glacier, you know, man pack up there, and you know, be up there, and they made a little cabin, out of wood. The geologists were man pack, and they had little hand crank radios. One would sit on it, and while the other one turned the handle, and the one sitting on it would talk, so they could report back to the base. So I had to be in communication with them at certain periods. They'd leave all the dogs behind, so I had something like 40 dogs to feed. And one time there, I was on my own. Jim Simpson didn't like the idea of being on my own, but I got a feeling it was one of the geologists that hurt his ankle. So the doc, who would normally been in the base with me, I said, "You can go, I'm all right on my own, don't worry about me." And so I had all these dogs for company. And I say I was busy anyway, you're cooking for yourself. I'd got the radio, because I was doing, which was something we added in, sort of propagation research by monitoring every night at certain times. We monitored different stations we picked up to see how the signals varied in strength and what we picked. And they, when we came back, Dixie had been doing it as well. When we came back, we went to Admiralty signals and I think it was then known as ASW, Admiralty Signal and Weapons Establishment. It changed to Admiralty Signals and Radar Establishment later. And one of the civilian boffins with us worked up, we produced a booklet on propagation conditions in the Arctic regions and all that sort of thing. Little booklet. So that was doing all, doing all those.
So you were monitoring the sort of wireless conditions.
Yeah, propagation conditions and high temperatures, high latitudes rather, not temperatures, high latitude. Another thing I did actually when the dock was back in the base, there were a lot of fish in this big lake, and highly illegal, but we had a lot of P3 explosive. They went out in a rowboat and dropped explosive over to try and get some fish to study them, because most of the fish, I read in a book by Jack Stove later, that 90% go to the bottom anyway. And I suggested to the doc that, as an interest, we, study these fish, something to do. Now, I had to provide earth mats for radio arrows, because you need a good earth. We had these long copper earth mats, like a mesh, like netting sort of things, and I said we could build a trap and trap the fish, because coming down the mountain into the lake was all these little tiny streams, and because coming down they would bring little bits of lich and moss and all bits and pieces, and obviously there's Arctic hares out there, Arctic fox, muskox roaming around up in the mountains, and dung and that sort of thing, so the fish would tend to gather around these because there was food there, see. So Doc, he was a National Service naval officer, and he did his National Service on the expedition. He was a Scotsman, went to live in Melbourne. He had the name of someone at Edinburgh University in the fishy business, shall we say. And so they suggested what we do, and they told us what to do to catch the fish, measure them, study the shape, colouring, everything else, and then drop them into formaldehyde. Because once they go in there, they lose their sort of colour, and then they could take them back and study them. And so we made these little traps in the shallows of the lake. And we had a little gate, and then we'd leave it for a while, and because the fish used to come in this little gate, you see, and we'd shut the gate, and because then we'd wade in, do what we did as kids with a bit of sacking, drag along and scoop the fish up, and we studied these, and when we sent them back, I think we sent Chun back when they come to do the resupply in the August. We also got some more later. And they said it was a new type of Arctic char. It hadn't been discovered before. Now, there's no rivers feeding into that lake. And so it must have been spawn dropped by birds or, dropping weed and that. And they wanted to give it a name, name it after. So, old Jock said to me, so were you the one with the idea? I said, wow. I said, I'm a radio man. I said, what do I want a fish named after me for? So, I said, you're a doctor, you're in the scientific era. And his name was Masterton, so they called it something Mastertony or something. And, added to more interest, while the expedition was there.
And, of course, it's less cold here. I mean, this tent is much lower
now. And, of course, I mean, you're walking around in your trousers and your shirt. I mean, mind you, on the ice cap, it's quite amazing, on the ice cap, if there is no wind at all and the sun's out, you can walk around in a singlet, even that temperature. It's quite amazing. And you get black. Because the amazing thing was, I said previously I went to Old Sarum, organising with the army boats for the airdrops. Well, they were on this plane that crashed, some of them. And because they'd seen me as a smart young man, In their sergeant's mess in the evening, having a drink with them, and then they saw me in the exhibition. I'd got frostbitten nose, and the sun makes your skin go black because it's so so clear. The sun up there, there's no sun.
Just very dark suntan.
Very dark, almost you go almost black. Really dark, and they didn't recognise me at first because you're unshaven. I got frostbite, unshaven, dark skin. But it's quite amazing. As soon as it gets to one knot of wind, and then you can't stand it. But if there's no wind at all and that sun's shining, I'm not talking about minus 80, I'm talking about perhaps minus 40 or 50 or something like that.
Now, so how did this come to an end then?
Well, we
you finish in well, 56, well, I think.
Yeah, we had the resupply, and then in 54 is when it comes to an end.
Sorry,
54.
Yes, it's not. Yes,
54.
It's January 55. Yeah. You finish.
Now, obviously, we couldn't bring everything home. I mentioned earlier on they lost one of their petrol diesel generators. Well, when they brought the resupply up, when I was there, they brought another petrol engine, which we fitted up. So I had two diesels, and the chaps was absolutely delighted because they'd been rationed on electricity before, but I was able to give the scientists and everybody else a sort of 100% diesel and electricity, and I still had the one from the radio room. And, you know, the lighting. And what I did, I got a clipboard for the one that they were allowed to use, because the other one was for the radio, solely radio room. So the lab and the lighting and everything else, and the radios and that sort of thing in the living room, they had the other diesel. But I set two clipboards up and ruled them up, and I showed them how to start the diesel so they could all start and stop them. And if anybody wanted power, they came and all they just wrote when they're the time they started it up, you know, and time they switched it off. And we were asked to return the diesels, and we said we couldn't return two heavyweight diesels, so they said that if we could return the moving parts for analysis. Well, I'm not an engineer, I'm a sparker, but I knew them in the parts. So what I did, I stripped the engines down before we come home, because, you know, apart from that, I didn't pack all my radio gear. I'm get all that packed up to come home.
Was the whole exhibition expedition finishing?
Oh yes, everybody. I mean, we didn't have the same. We didn't have to have a ship taking stuff home. We weren't taking massive, equipment and that sort of thing. What I did, I stripped them down, and from the one engine, I put a little blob of red paint on each part, and then the other one I got blue paint with the accompanying sheets. When we got back home, Petters said, would I go, and I think it was Maidenhead, to meet their designers and engineers and board, to discuss these engines, you see. And I said to the boss, I'm not an engineer, so I can't discuss engines with him. He said, well, you've got to go along, you're the one that's been using them. Well, as it was a good idea I kept them, because I just kept them because there was oily marks and grease marks on these sheets, so they were obviously genuine, where people had sort of had to fill up the diesel and start them. And when I got to their headquarters in Maidenhead, as I walked in the room, before we started, I said, can I point out to you all that I'm a sparker and not an engineer? They said, perfect. We don't design our engines for engineers. He said, they're for farmers and people like that. And he said, the first question we asked, did you find the handbook sufficiently informative? And I said, yeah, excellent, no problems. Good. They said, because we know more about that engine than you do. So we've had a look at the parts and we can tell you the history of it. And they were amazed, actually, because of the clean air up there, how little wear there was on those engines. They couldn't believe it. And the other thing was...
Now, how did you got back to England?
We came back in flying boats. And...
right back to England?
No, to Reykjavik first. The first, there was four flying boats, and the first, the Sunderland flying boats, every time we tried to take off, we was doing this, up and down, which the aircrew informed me was what they call porpoising. And you had to pull right back, go back again and start again, and it's like porpoising again. And they had to pull back because it was dangerous. And when they checked, they found out a hatch had been left open, a load of water had got in the basin, that's what was doing it. So once they pumped that out, it was all right. And we were sat in the back of these salmons. Now, we were going back to Pembroke Dock, and of course the news people and the media knew we were coming back, and everybody was waiting for us to come back.
Now, this is January, is it? 1955?
No, this is 54. We came back in 54.
When about?
August time, something like that. August. Would that be August? Because that's when the lake freeze.
Okay. So you flew back to Reykjavik?
And then from Reykjavik to Pembroke Dock. Now, they're getting ready, you know, because they know the cameras are all out, you know, the television, Pathy News, whatever you, are all waiting. These Sunderland flying boats are flying in a triangular formation. There's the leader in front. Two aircraft either side, slightly below him, tucked, they were so close, you know, tucked just a bit under him. And then we were at the back of the triangle, just a bit lower than those two. And they're flying in merrily, and all of a sudden, and because from the crash Hastings on the ice cap, I collected myself a pair of the headphones they use internally. So in the back of the Hastings, there's little plug points where you can plug in and listen to what's going on, like between the crew talking and also when they're on the radio. I'm plugged in here, and I'm looking through the window on the side of the sun, and all of a sudden I saw this one on the right, just as if someone had pulled it backwards. It just disappeared back. I went, oh, and the crew member said, oh, he said, he must have had one of his engines cut out. See? But it looked as if he'd been pulled backwards. See? Next thing he caught up. We're coming into Pembroke Dock, and I always remember there's a hill at the back as we were coming in, and there's a big building on the hill with a flagpole. And I'm listening on these headphones. And of course, the squadron leader's, you know, making a nice impression coming in low. Two planes on the side are lower than him, just tucked under him. And we're lower than that, tucked. And he was just going to clear this flagpole. We'd have gone straight through it. And I heard my pilot call out all sorts of things to the squadron leader. And he pulled up quick, you see. And I thought, and to see these planes, I mean, I suppose it's different if you see the red arrows, it's such a sleek thing. These big lumbering Sunderlands, and they're wobbling like this, and they're so close to one another, and they're drifting around. And I don't think I've been so frightened in my life. And then we've just passed over, having got just cleared this flagpole on the top of this building at the back of Pembroke Dock, and came over the radio that the cameraman wanted us to go round again. So we had to go round again. Anyway, we landed safely, and from there, you know, sort of caught the train back. You know,
were there lots of interviews, or were you interviewed by anybody?
Not really, no. We sort of got in our way, and when we got back, my main job with Dixie Dean, and we had to sort of, we worked with one of the Merchant Navy officers, because there were certain stores that were, for instance, the seismic, I think they call it a seismograph, the seismic machine, I think was very, very expensive. It was a very delicate instrument and very, very expensive, which had been loaned by Shell. And we were most anxious to see that this got back safely. And other things that other people had to get back, like we had on trial, they wanted to do a test and examine. I mean, there wasn't a lot of stuff, but it all had to be sorted. And because there was lots of our own personal kit, so that was one of our jobs. And so we stopped in London at the time. I was Taffy Oakley, one of the Army vehicle artificers. He knew the landlord and landlady of a pub at the back of...
Doesn't matter.
Just off the Charing Cross Road at the back somewhere. Not a very nice area, but, you know, nice people, and of course we hadn't a lot of money, and just get a nice big meal there and stop there.
Now, why didn't you have a lot of money? You should have had 2 years worth of money.
I hadn't got it by then.
So you were unpacking, basically.
Yeah, and seeing stuff got back. The amazing thing was, we were so worried about this seismograph. Seismic machine, or seismograph, I think, I'm not sure the full term, because it was so expensive. And when we got back, we rang up Shell Mex to say where did they want it delivered, and they said, we don't want it back. Just give it to you. From their point of view, she'd been out of their hands, on a rough, you know, it was a delicate instrument. You know, I don't suppose it was worth them, you know, checking it. And it was bequeathed. We sent it to one of the universities. I can't remember which one now.
So did you get any leave and your pay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but we paid so much towards the expedition as well. Everybody had to pay towards it. That's a general thing. We didn't pay a lot. Actually, the scientists were worse off because I got my naval pay. I had to pay a small amount towards the expedition, but it wasn't a lot. But I got my naval pay. But scientists didn't get anything, basically.
So,
but mind you,
why did you have to contribute to the expedition? I can't say that today.
All costs. It's been an old thing with all polar expeditions that people pay towards the funding of it, the costing of it. I mean, ours were minimal, not a lot. I can't remember when I got me paid.
So you should still have had 18 months' pay then?
Yeah.
So did you get leave?
Oh, well, from getting rid of all the stores, the one thing I asked to do, and I wasn't allowed to do it, because then I was going to go back to the Navy, I said, we've learnt a lot. You know, I'm talking about radio communications, about not only radio propagation, but what happens to batteries in cold conditions, what happens to wire. I mean, for instance, the Canadians were better at this than us. Most of their radios, the wire shielding was pure rubber. Most of ours was plastic. And as soon as they got knocked, the plastic was snappy brittle. So you had bare wires, and, you know, plastic used to break. There's all sorts of things. The amazing thing was, because of the amount of equipment in the base up, we had 230 volts AC power supply. We had 24 volts DC power supply, 12 volts DC power supply for different types of equipment. So we had banks of batteries which we had to charge. Now we had these banks of batteries in layers. And it's amazing, even in the base hut with the heat in the base hut, that on the ground could never get fully charged. As soon as you took them up a bit off the floor, there was all sorts of... And I wanted to write a booklet for advice for people following. And, you know, they said, oh, no, we could get back to... And I always think it's a sad thing. So many times, you know, people do things and it's never passed on to someone. One thing I did do before I went back was the British Transantarctic Expedition was leaving, you know, Bunny Fuchs, the leader, or was it Dr. Fuchs, but he was known as Bunny Fuchs. And one of our members one of the staff sergeant, Remy, who was vehicle artist, had gone home after 1 year, and he was relieved by Roy Homard, who was a warrant officer, second class vehicle artist. Well, he went from us to the Antarctic expedition, and I was asked to go and give him some advice, and they had an RAF sergeant who was going to go there, and I was able to give him, pass on some information and advice to them, which, you know, they thought was very helpful. So, you know, at least I was able to pass something on. But then, when all this was done, I went to, say, ASWE, where for a while we worked on this propagation report. And then back to the Navy.
So you never got any leave?
Oh, yeah, I got some leave, yeah. Can't remember it now.